I'm Wolf Harand, Oscar Echo One Whiskey Hotel Charlie, the honorary curator of what is usually known as the QSL Collection, an international foundation, a research and documentation center for the history of radio communications and the electronic media. In connection with our Don Miller project, I talked to Don, XW9WNW, on the 31st of December 2002.
I was born in 1936 in Chicago, Illinois, and I guess the important part is that I became interested in amateur radio while I was in high school and as a young teenager in Chicago, and through some friends who were also hams, I was intrigued, not so much by the electronic end of things, but at the time we were in what we called the Cold War, where there were strained relations between the United States and the Eastern European countries, mainly the Soviet Union. And what intrigued me the most, because I was studying politics and always enjoyed geography and world affairs, was the fact that while we had no contact with the Russians, our hams and the Russian hams were able to talk freely, or more or less freely exchange basic information at will. It seemed to be a very open means of communication.
Did you plan to become a politician?
No, I was just interested in it. My father was an attorney, and I was interested in law, although the line of legal work he was in had to do with medical cases, and I eventually became more interested in medicine than law. But at the time, I was still in high school, prior to any college or postgraduate work. No, this was when I was approximately 16 years old and studying in high school, and I became interested in amateur radio through these friends, and I studied to obtain my, what we then called the novice class exam, which required a 5-word-per-minute code test and a basic, very simple exam, and I became WN9WNV. In 1952, and in order to have access to the DX bands, and my interest was primarily CW, sideband was just then coming into vogue, I passed the 13-word-per-minute test and became a general class W9WNV. I had trouble with DX because I lived in a very low, crowded building, and the only antenna that I could put up was a whip, a mobile antenna on the roof, and the bands were not exactly open then, the high-frequency bands. But eventually we moved to a taller building in that area of Chicago and more conducive to antennas. And around 1955, 1956, I became very active on the high-frequency bands, 10, 15, and 20 meters primarily, and enjoyed working DX country after country, mostly on CW, but a little bit on AM.
So you must have worked the very first the Expeditioners as well.
Then the Expeditioners were W0MLY. We called him Womley Dick. He's still living in W0 part of the country, I think Kansas. And Gus Browning, W4BPW. And Danny Weil had been active through the ASME expedition. Dick Spensley, the KV4AA, was the one running that, and ACK, W4ECI in Alabama, was sponsoring the Gus Browning expedition at the time, and Womley was parading all over Africa, so there was plenty of expeditions going on, I mean the good old-fashioned kind.
And did you plan to become an expeditioner yourself at that time?
I had no plans to, but I was always interested in traveling. I was also always interested in, one of the things that fascinated me were expeditions, not the expeditions, but real expeditions. The sagas of Shackleton at the South Pole, and Byrd and Peary, and some of the explorers, which always interested me. However, I finished high school, and entered college to become to what we call pre-medical studies at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, where they had a W3 club station, which I operated from time to time. I went through pre-medical there, and between between approximately 1957 and 1961, I completed medical school back in Chicago and became an MD, a medical doctor. During that time, I couldn't be as active as I wanted to be, but I did participate in a number of DX contests, and I think I was up to somewhere between 200 and 300 countries in DXCC on almost all the bands from 10 through 160 meters. I made the acquaintance of a number of DXers and DXpeditioners at the Dayton Hamvention. You know, got to know many of the DXers on a first name basis because we competed in the contests and we competed for all the new countries. But I was not one of these real avid DXCC people that would work every country. First of all, I was very busy with my medical studies and just didn't have the time. But when I finished medical school and finished my internship around 1960 to 1961, I decided to enlist in the military rather than to be drafted, which might interrupt my medical career. I decided to do that time and get it served first. Well, I enlisted in the Air Force, and lo and behold, I was assigned to go to Korea in 1961 in the Air Force as a medical doctor or flight surgeon.
What was your rank at that time?
Captain. I underwent some basic training first in the United States, and then I was transported to South Korea in 1961. One of the advantages as an officer was that you were allowed to take a certain amount of personal effects, and I contacted somebody on the airbase, and they arranged through the Korean amateur radio or licensing authority to have a HL9 call sign, which was being given to American troops in Korea at the time. So I was assigned the call sign HL9KH, and when I arrived on the base, they had not only no amateur radio there, but they didn't have even what we called a MARS station at the time. MARS, the military amateur radio system, was run by amateurs throughout the military, mainly to facilitate the American soldiers and GIs to talk back home with their families on phone patches and the like. But we didn't have a MARS station on the base either, so I, in addition to my medical duties, I was given permission to set up a MARS station and at the same time put up the antennas, basically a tri-bander and some Collins equipment, which I had shipped over there. So I became HL9KH. Korea was not a particularly rare country, but I was amazed at how many thousands of amateurs apparently had not had any contact with any HL9. They had told me one after another that it was a new country for them, and I became aware that the elite or upper crust of DXers high on the honor roll were but a small fraction of those that were interested in DX. At the time, there were many, many thousands of amateurs throughout the world in all the countries who were running 25 watts or 50 watts with just a dipole, for example, who hadn't had the opportunity to talk to many of the even semi-scarce countries such as Korea. So during my year to year and a half there, I was very active on all of the bands and participated in contests, of course. And then had the idea that there were some countries in that area and some places which qualified as countries under DXCC, which hadn't been activated. So with the help of some friends, I explored the possibility of using my military leave time to go to a couple of such places, and that's what happened. One was Rota Island, which was in the Marianas, which qualified as a separate country on distance parameters. Parisi Vila was another one. So we did those two expeditions. Well, we had help from some military transportation to get to them. One was an island, the other was more like a small reef type island. It was just a wonderful experience organizing and carrying out those two operations during the year that I was stationed in Korea. Well, I enjoyed all aspects of it. I always enjoyed operating pileups, for example, especially on CW, which is more or less of an art form. C CW has always been my favorite. And I enjoyed the mechanics of organizing something, especially when there's only one operator, only one ham. Of course, you need some help, but trying to organize an efficient operation where one person can basically satisfy the desire of most of the hams who are seeking the new country or the place where you're going, and trying to do it on all the different bands within a period of time to keep your equipment running, to have backup equipment, your power, your fuel, your transportation is quite an operation for one person when you're in a more or less remote part of the world. Of course, today's the expeditions are quite a bit different, but at the time, it was exciting to pull off something like that, and I enjoyed very much and there was a lot of gratification in it that you could tell that you were fulfilling sort of a need, both for entertainment, and of course, many DXers consider it more than entertainment.
So you ended up in a routine of a couple of expeditions. You went on your own, then you were joined by Ted and Chuck. I suppose we should talk about the two of them as well.
Well, during the time I was in Korea, I talked frequently with a fellow named Chuck Swain, who was stationed, he worked at the time for the CIA branch of the American government, stationed in Laos, and we had many conversations, and he was interested also in going on a de-expedition. When I finished my year of service in Korea, I completed my military training back in the United States in California, and when my tour of duty was up, I joined briefly a branch of the CIA for 6 months and went over to Southeast Asia, where I personally met Chuck Swain. And during my 6 months in Laos, the two of us planned that we would spend a couple of years traveling to as many rare and scarce places or new countries for DXCC purposes as we could. Chuck had some connections to help us get into some of the countries in Southeast Asia, such as Burma, which was very difficult to travel to at the time, Vietnam, which had not had any amateur radio activity, Thailand, Cambodia. Cambodia was extremely rare. With his connections, we were able to maneuver some licenses and to get our equipment into some of those countries. So after my tour of duty was up there, Chuck and I planned to go to as many Southeast Asia countries as possible. In order to do so, we needed some resources. So we used our own funds, and eventually ACK, W4ECI, who had sponsored Gus Browning's expeditions, gave us some backing. So we were able to operate from Burma, Vietnam, Cambodia, Thailand, and a number of rare and new places from Southeast Asia over the period of, I would say, 4 to 6 months. This was around 1965, 1966.
Don, would these licenses be okay according to today's standards, or did they justify us at the time to convince the DXCC people?
Well, what was needed for DXCC then was basically what's needed now, although it was less formal. You needed to have a valid license from the government that controlled the place where you were operating from. You, of course, needed to be in that place. There was never a formal requirement that you had to have a valid passport or anything like that. You had to have a valid license, and you had to operate from the place. Now, the licenses were valid. The licenses were not as difficult as the permission to travel to that particular place. We had to really pull some strings and go to great lengths to get permission to go, for example, to Burma at the time. I used the fact that I was a medical doctor to find a loophole to be able to do that, and Chuck being my so-called assistant. And we actually had to visit a couple of hospitals and do things while we were in places under that guise, but we were there, legally there. The license, many of the people in government didn't even know what ham radio was, but if any license authority would give you a rubber stamp or a written permission, that was good enough for ARRL and DXCC at the time. In most cases, we were actually given a call sign, but we often had to suggest what the call sign would be because some of these agencies weren't quite aware even of the amateur radio parameters because they hadn't had any for a while. But I can say that those operations were all valid. I don't think any of them were ever questioned as far as the validity of the license and being in the proper place at the proper time. But it was quite dangerous. That was the other part of aspect of it. It was quite dangerous because especially Americans were being arrested and detained, and we were detained several times, particularly when you're carrying a great deal of amateur radio equipment. We were carrying basically two sets of Collins radio equipment, which were in Samsonite suitcases, each set consisting of a transmitter and receiver, or a transceiver and VFO, plus a 30L1 linear amplifier. Two sets of those, a big tri-band beam, which was broken down into small size, a rotator, four or five cases of wires and collapsible poles, all sorts of tools, relays, keyers, microphones, you name it, plus a couple of 1,300-watt generators, and usually we could get fuel where we were. But we were lugging all of this around with us, and it was very suspicious to the authorities as to what this actually was. Once in a while, there was a payoff involved, or we had to leave equipment somewhere and just leave it there, and it was touch and go, but it was probably the most satisfying part of the whole 3 years of de-expeditioning to have pulled off those operations. When we had done all that we were able to do in Southeast Asia and were raising funds to continue, our plan was to go across the Pacific. And what we arranged was that first I went to as many different islands as I could to try to secure licenses. For example, when I was in Australia, in Sydney, I did obtain permission to operate a Heard Island license. I think it was VK0ADY at some time in the future, which we didn't do at the time. And this is where some of the controversy came in when I was making my way across the Pacific, at first just to obtain licenses and explore the different transportations that we might secure to some of the rarer places. And then later, when Chuck joined me and we began sailing to some of these places. See, at the time, Western Samoa, which was then called British Samoa, the Tonga Islands, which were called the Friendly Islands, and the New Hebrides, and especially places like Nui Island, were considered quite rare at that time, except amongst the very highest level of DXers. When Chuck joined me, we were sailing in this small 38-foot catch called the Marinero to a lot of these places. And sometimes when there were small planes that we could hitch a ride and go by plane, we would do so in between. On many of these islands when we would land, Danny Weil had been to a number of them. And the people were kind of perplexed why we would want to land all of our gear on these islands and operate. On two or three different locations, we were told, well, why don't you just operate from your boat like this last fellow did. Well, at first I had trouble understanding what they were trying to tell me, but apparently Danny went to all of the places, or most of the places that he said he was at, but it became apparent that he didn't actually land his equipment on the island. He would operate from his boat, which was a lot easier, especially if you're alone. So that's when I first became aware that, in fact, some of my heroes had actually not been 100% legitimate. By that point, we had operated from all of the places where we said we were, and everything was perfectly legitimate up until that, around that time. And by the way, the Marinero was not a very safe ship, but we were traveling on a very limited budget. Maybe $30 or $40 a day was all we were able to spend. It was all we could afford. The boat owner was another medical doctor, a fellow from Hawaii whom I had met.
When did Ted Thorpe join the group?
During the course of this, I had many contacts with Ted Thorpe, who was a radio announcer and television announcer from Wellington, New Zealand. ZL2AWJ was his call sign, and he had told me a couple of times that he always wanted to go on the expedition. So we arranged. He had a few weeks he could get off of work, and he joined us and participated along with Chuck and I. So we had actually three hams at that point, sometimes one or two of us, sometimes all three at some of those islands. And this kind of brings us up to the point of the first real tragedy of the expedition, which was...
And we're talking now about January the 28th, 1966, isn't it?
Yeah, when the hurricane hit Samoa. Up until that point, each of these stops was not only legitimate, but sometimes I would have to work almost 24 hours a day because one or the other bands would be open. And if I were the only one operating, why, of course, you kind of feel obligated to give as many people contacts as you can. And you can tell when you get down to the third or fourth day that even though the signals are weaker, there are just as many waiting to make contact. And Chuck was mainly a phone operator. He did a little CW, but when we were together, I did most of the CW and a little phone, and he did mostly phone. Ted did both CW and phone. Things went kind of smoothly until that date that you mentioned. And what happened was there were five people on that boat. Chuck Swain, who was truly my best friend, Ted Thorpe, the two hams, Rudy Egli, who was a physician from Hawaii who owned this catch, and his girlfriend, Karen, who was pregnant with his child, and a Fijian lad that we had picked up who was a mate on the ship that helped us with the sailing. And we last saw each other in Pango Pango. Our funds were running low, and I was scheduled to return to visit some amateur radio clubs in the United States and in South America, and ACK had some speaking engagements where we would show some color slides and raise a little money so that we could continue. And I took off for the United States and South America, and they were in Pango Pango and waiting for the weather to clear to go to a place called Wallace Island, which was an isolated French territory in the Pacific, which was a separate, very rare country. And while I was gone, they took off for the island. And during my tour, I think I was in Caracas, Venezuela, somewhere in South America at the time, I had received word that the Wallace Island operation was a success. They had a good operation there, several days on all the bands, Chuck and Ted. And, of course, I was to meet them back in Pango Pango, and we were going to resume. But that they had not returned to Pango Pango. There had been a severe tropical hurricane. And the ship had not shown up in port. We contacted Wallace Island by wireless, and they had confirmed that they had departed there. So we knew we were in trouble. And I aborted my speaking tour and flew back to Pango Pango in Samoa. And it was not a pretty sight. The island was devastated by one of the most severe hurricanes they had ever experienced. Even 100-foot steel fishing boats had sunk. So our little 38-foot wooden boat, which was not very seaworthy, it leaked. And it was grim. In any part of the world where there's a disaster like this, there's some country that's responsible for searching by a what used to be at least then an international treaty at Ottawa or Geneva. And in that area, New Zealand was the country that was responsible. So New Zealand cooperated, and at our request they sent a seaplane, which was called the Sunderland Flying Boat, and a search and rescue team to search for our missing boat. At the same time, I was able to get cooperation from some of my Air Force friends at Hickam Air Force Base in Hawaii, which also sent a second search plane. So we got volunteers from the locals to search. You know, a search plane flies very low, and there is a person at every window looking down through the window as the plane flies over a grid area, one grid at a time. And we searched day after day after day. We found one piece of wood, which I identified, which was from our boat, from the Marinero, because I knew the color of the inside of the hull, and there was no doubt that it was from our ship. But nothing else was found. It was very discouraging. And they called off the search, and the planes left. And I wasn't entirely satisfied because the drift rate was pretty strong, and there was a chance that they could have drifted, particularly in one direction. And I flew down to New Zealand and met Ted's wife, Colleen Thorpe, and we went to Wellington, and they agreed to return another search team to search some more. So we had another plane for about another week, and we searched additional areas, but we still turned up nothing. So that was probably the worst moment of my life. I guess just by fate, I was still alive, and everybody else was dead. And I went to Hawaii to talk to the families of Karen and Rudy, and I flew to Tennessee to see Chuck's mother, and I was about ready to hang it up, but somehow the DX fraternity was very supportive and very sympathetic, and I thought that perhaps we should finish the job. So I went back, found a fellow in Auckland that had a small boat that would suffice, and then continued in the expedition. Chuck and I had plans to go through some of the East African and Indian Ocean areas, particularly, and even the Caribbean. And I more or less did that on my own for the next year and a half following the disaster.